Hey there. Thanks for joining me on Comedy Masterclass, where I interview creators about the craft of writing comedy.
Hey, everybody. Today, I am thrilled to have John Darablaney with me. Now, John is a writer, creator, and brand builder extraordinaire. When I was going through John's bio, trying to decide what to pull out from his creative projects, I was so spoiled for choice. It's like, do I tell you he was Crackers, the corporate crime-fighting chicken back in the day on Michael Moore's TV Nation? Or do I mention his speed metal ukulele band, You Till You Puke, which is such a fun name? Or importantly, that he has written hundreds of hours of TV and produced TV for big companies like the Jim Henson Company and for Lego, and so much more, all of which positions John brilliantly to be a person to help us out with how we can think about storytelling and design that works across multiple platforms, a concept I think is really important to us as creators in today's age. And John is such an expert in this that people hire him to bring sense to it. And I'm going to dig into one of the terms that he's coined, super narrative, what that means in terms of storytelling and design. So many things to ask you about today, John. But before we dive in, is there anything else people should know about you and your work or connections to comedy?
Well, first off, thanks for having me on. I just do try a lot of things because a lot of them fail and a lot of them fail badly. So you just, you know, 4 out of 5 things I do fail. Some of them succeed and, you know, I've been managing to pay my rent and, you know, live. So that's basically my overall philosophy, and keep trying different things. As you could see from your description of what I've done, it's pretty eccentric sometimes.
Yeah, but really inspiringly so, and so necessary as a creative. So I love it. And normally I don't go back through people's career, but actually you've done so many interesting things I want to just touch lightly on before we work our way to super narrative, because I do think they're really relevant in terms of comedy and how we like stack our skills up and how we might move from one thing to another. So I'd actually love to go like way back and ask you about founding a comedy newspaper. So I believe that you co-founded the Hoboken Review and also were a contributor to National Lampoon, which is super fascinating in terms of comedy. If you were just going to pull out one or two things that you really remember from that time, or that you feel like you learned from that time in relation to comedy or creating, what do you think they would be?
Well, I can go even farther back. Why I started doing comedy.
It was basically,
I mostly grew up in a place called Bayside, Queens, which is a very nice neighborhood, but also, especially in the 1970s, really kind of tough. Mm. And people are always sort of like fighting. If you're familiar with Donald Trump, Donald Trump grew up in Jamaica Estates. That's a few miles away from Bayside. So a lot of people have that same sort of abrasive, aggressive, alpha male quality, you know, where they're always making up nicknames and always sort of bullying people. That's just how Queens is. Mm. So I was born later in the year, in October. In my entire grade, I was always smaller than everyone. So, you know, I was basically surrounded in a class of these sort of Donald Trump-esque characters, you know, and I was like the quiet, you know, book smart guy, you know, trying to speak in full sentences as opposed to, you know, the common street thug vernacular of Queens. And so I was a super easy target to, you know, get bullied and beat up. And I realized if I could make people laugh, they would maybe not punch me in the face, maybe confuse them enough that I could run away. So that's where I started honing my, comedy skills and, you know, reading National Lampoon and watching Monty Python, which was like eye-opening at the time for me, you know, that there was this other kind of comedy, not this American vaudeville stuff that, you know, we fill our sitcoms with. So that's how I started, you know, doing comedy. Didn't realize you could make a living from it. So I went into journalism and I actually went to journalism school and became a journalist, which is rare because most of the people in journalism programs do something else. And I got a job doing, you know, working for a newspaper in Hoboken, New Jersey, and worked my way up. I was a staff of two. I worked my way up from reporter to editor. And eventually the publisher was like, it was the late 80s at that point. There'd been a stock market crash in New York. He's like, oh, everyone's depressed. We're in this economic malaise. It was that late 80s malaise. We need to make people laugh. So I'm going to give you a tiny budget and you're going to make a comedy newspaper. You know, basically, it was kind of like the Onion. When the Onion came out, it was originally a newspaper. It looked like, I actually have copies. It looked something like this.
Oh, fabulous.
And it was called the Hoboken Review. And we basically reviewed like ridiculous things like parking meters or weird books at the library or, you know, buffets at strip bars, you know, which pizzeria in Hoboken had the best celebrity headshots. It just, yeah. But it was an excuse to review things and just sort of, you know, make jokes and also sort of maybe reach some sort of truth about the world. And it lasted 21 issues, but, you know, it was kind of groundbreaking in a way because it was 1990 when it came out. No one was doing this. There was, you know, there were college humor magazines and there was Spy magazine was something in that was very prominent in New York at the time. But this was a local Hoboken humor magazine, humor newspaper. The benefit of it was a lot of people in Hoboken also work in media places in New York. And someone from National Lampoon saw that. And I ended up writing for National Lampoon before it went out of business.
Oh.
So, and then, of course, from there, once you're in National Lampoon, that feeds a lot of the TV comedy TV jobs in New York. So I ended up working at a show on Comedy Central called Night After Night with Alan Havey, which is a late night talk show, just doing gags, you know, reading the newspaper and making jokes. It was every day. So it's pretty brutal.
Yeah. And what do you think that has in common with, if anything, with then Crackers the corporate crime fighting chicken in terms of that comedy journalism? What do you think, what function does that fulfill? What's great about it?
I mean, everything. Cause I had an actual real sort of journalism background. I could go out and I could report things. I mean, whenever I would go to do a story, I was always sort of more interested in like the eccentric qualities of people. Like if it's a mayor or some head of the planning commission and they had a snow globe collection, I wanted to write about that.
Right.
I'd somehow put the really quirkiness of all the people I met. So I was always sort of putting that in my journalism, but at the same time, it was also actually reporting, you know, oh, they changed the zoning laws or the sewage treatment plant is broken or what, you know, the stuff you do in local journalism. So when I eventually moved into comedy, I had this background both in journalism and comedy and somehow got connected with Michael Moore. Mm. And, you know, it made a lot of sense at that time because he was literally inventing this new form of TV that's become really prominent now that mixed sort of a journalistic approach with comedy, with humor and sort of stunts. So, you know, it was very easy for me to get in there. Once I got in, I mean, I could pitch things and I could say, you know, this will be funny and it has this point that we can make at the same time. Mm. And Crackers. So at the time in the US, there was something called McGruff, the crime dog. Mm. It was this dog mascot, take a bite out of crime. It was like, it was like about street crime, you know, report street crime. And Michael's idea was we should do something like that about, you know, corporate crime because, you know, those are the real criminals. You know, if you get mugged, that's, you know, you lose $50, but, you know, there are white collar criminals stealing millions and billions. So we're going to have this corporate crime mascot called Crackers, the corporate crime fighting chicken. Mm. And I sort of got put on that as a writer and, you know, helping direct it. And I spent a lot of time shouting into the original performer's ear, say this and this. And I said, can I just wear the suit? You know, and I think he thought I had a funny voice. And if I pitch it up, it is kind of a funny voice. Mm. But if I pitch it up a little, it sounds even more cartoony. Like Crackers, corporate crime fighting chicken, you know? And any time you doesn't really matter how effective your interview is. The moment you walk into sort of a corporate office dressed as a giant chicken, you win. Right. The CEO at the other end of the table has lost because for some dumb reason he saw a camera and he wanted to be on TV and he didn't realize it would be an interview with a giant chicken.
Yeah. So. And when you think back to like what you were sort of itching to get the other person to say, what do you think you were trying to do if there were any patterns to make the joke work better or to make it be sharper? What kind of things do you think you could see that maybe they couldn't?
It wasn't that hard.
Was it not?
Well, I mean, it was like an 8-foot tall chicken. Yeah. And I mean, I'd ask hard hitting questions. Why didn't you correct the pollution at this factory? But when it's coming out of the mouth of a chicken, you know, when the person would give a serious response, you cut back to the reaction shot of, you know, me being a chicken or sniffing my wings or something. It was almost like doing a straight interview as a chicken. So you couldn't win. And I mean, there's, you know, the thing about comedy, it's always the reaction shot, you know, the laugh, at least in American comedy, a lot of the laugh comes on there's the joke and then you cut to the person reacting to it. And in that situation, you just, ask a question and cut to the chicken. Yeah. and it works.
Yeah.
The downside was it was physically exhausting. It was so hot.
Yeah.
I had them put a fan in the suit, but we couldn't leave the fan on during an interview because of for sound issues. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
The good news, it was, you know, it was the 90s. It was a simpler time. You know, people wanted to be on camera, you know.
Right.
They were just thrilled to be getting attention. I think the world has changed now that anyone can put themselves on, you know, the internet. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's wild. And from there to like Nickelodeon and so many of the sort of long-term contracts that you had working in animation and children's shows, what was your focus through the comedy lens there, and how did that fit with animation?
Well, everything sort of came from Crackers, because someone from the Henson Company saw that and they're like, "Oh, you can do a walk around." I'm like, "Sure, yes." You know, yeah. This is the thing I've learned about Hollywood: just say yes.
Right.
You know, people ask, "Can you write a song?" Yeah. Can you direct? Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, and then figure it out on the way.
Right.
And at that point, I'm like, "Sure, I can do a walk around." I'm like, "What's a walk around?" Mm. And a walk around, it turns out, is that suit. It's like Big Bird.
Yeah.
You know, and so I somehow got their attention, and I pitched some ideas. And you know, I was a huge, huge Muppet fan growing up. The Muppets, I mean, no one seems to remember this, but they were an adult sort of brand. Mm. There was the Sesame Street Muppets, but then the Muppet Show was like, you know, teenagers and adults would watch it because it was so hip and funny at the time, 70s and 80s. So getting to work there was phenomenal. Except for one time. One time I was in a studio, and they had all the Muppets laid out in plastic bags. And, you know, we think about it, at least Muppets are alive in my head. But I saw them all laid out, and I thought, oh, it's like a Muppet plane crash.
Oh.
These are the Muppet corpses in their body bags. Oh. And I was kind of upset about it, because, you know, these are, Gonzo was there, and he's not moving, you know, wanted to give him CPR. So, but other than that, it was good. It was a good experience. And from there, you know, we started doing kids TV. I had kids and, you know, had some success in that. I'm also Canadian. A lot of production is done in Canada. So that made a lot of sense. And then that led to the toy and branding world, because, you know, I did some shows, and I did this one show, Wayside, which was an adaptation of a very popular kids book called Wayside books. There's like three of them.
Is that Louis Secker?
Yes, the Louis Secker book. Yes, worked a little bit with Louis Secker. I don't know if he loved what I did, but it was, you know, I do a lot of adaptations, and that you have to finesse that sort of relationship. So that was a success. You know, there's this old thing, this old saying I heard in TV. It's like, to have a hit show, you need a great concept, a great script, amazing actors, you know, incredible director, and if it's a linear TV, a great time slot, and then you have to hit the lottery. So it's like, even then, you have to hit the lottery. You know, it's all, there's still this X factor of luck. So we got this show, we got a great source material. I wrote what I thought were good scripts. We had a great director. We got on Nickelodeon, you know, following SpongeBob, great time slot. And it did really well. You know, everything worked. It was going to get renewed. And the parent company, Nelvana, I think, they didn't want to renew it because it was not toyetic, a word that I hadn't until that time heard.
Toyetic?
And toyetic.
What's that?
Toyetic. T-O-Y-E-T-I-C.
Yeah.
That is a character in a show or property must be easily translate into toys.
Got you.
So Batman is toyetic because he's got a vehicle, you know.
Right.
Paw Patrol's, it's a toy basically, but you know, Wayside, which is just about kids in a school, there's no toys. I mean even SpongeBob is, I wouldn't even call that toyetic. Toyetic's usually action shows. So once I heard that, I'm like, next thing, I'm doing a show with toys.
Right.
So my agent somehow found someone at Lego, and they had just started Ninjago, and I really wanted to work there. I actually animated, I'll send you this after the podcast.
Yeah.
I actually animated myself in Lego, begging for the job.
Oh, did you?
I do actually have animation skills. And yeah, I had made a little Lego figure of myself and made the mouth move and said, I really want to work for this job. You know, I really want to do this. And, you know, it worked. I was second, a lot of jobs I've been second choice, and somehow I get in there.
That's fabulous. Listeners, and watch out for that. I'll share that example because that's a lovely way, again, of just, like I say, you are wildly creative, but then it's had a practical payback.
Then we did a show called Legends of Chima, which, you know, I think made billions of dollars. I'm not sure. I mean, it went on for 3 years, over 40 episodes. Mm. And that's where I sort of developed this super narrative kind of concept.
Brilliant.
If you want to go into that.
Yeah, I do. I do want to go into that. And I say, and amazing to like have that very quick zip time travel through. We probably missed out like about 40 destinations on the way to arrive at super narrative. and so I've read about the concept only like through your website, and I'm very interested in it in the sense of, I think we're quite in unprecedented terms, times even rather than terms, unprecedented times in relation to how many different kinds of media and platform and where attention goes and how things are constructed right now. So as a creator, I really want to learn from you about how you at least think about storytelling and design in a thoughtful way. But if some listeners may have heard different terms like transmedia or whatever, but will have not have heard, and I know it's different. So I'd love for it to clear up first of all, what you mean when you say super narrative, just on the most sort of basic of levels.
It's, you know, it's adjacent to transmedia. It's very similar.
Okay.
So the traditional model is you create a property, you create a SpongeBob, a Pokemon or something, and then you figure out, how can we make toys? Because really at the end of the day, in animation and in kids' TV, you don't make money until you have toys. You know, you could survive, you could pay your bills, you could keep your studio open, but if you really actually want to make money, which, you know, most people do, you have to have some sort of consumer products entity, you know, something's got to be sold out in the real world beyond just a license fee or a production budget. So usually they, you know, I'd previously worked on like the ridiculous shows where they'd always want to add a vehicle. A friend of mine worked on the Spider-Man cartoon, and the producers wanted to add a vehicle. Why does Spider-Man need a vehicle when he could swing through the air?
Yeah.
Because they can sell a toy. So you get all these ridiculous things like we have this great property. How do we turn it into a toy? In a super narrative, you start from the top thinking about all the things that are going to come from this. Mm. So it's not just a show. It's a show that's going to be a book. It's going to be a game. It's going to be a toy. It's going to be something we haven't even imagined. It's going to be a live experience. It's going to be something. It's going to be all these things. And you plan right from the start. Mm. So like the instance in Legends of Chima, a character will show up for 5 seconds in the episode, but he has a whole game or he has a whole book series based on him. So you pin him up, put him up here, and then he gets his whole life beyond. And if you're a super fan, and there are tons of super fans, they follow that stuff. Mm. Same thing with the video games. There's things that are hinted at, and you only really experience them when you play the video game. There's a couple of video games. The key thing is you create this whole story. There's like all these different pieces of a story, but one's going to go here, one's going to go there, one's going to go there. So you don't have to tell every single thing in the TV show. And these days, even TV shows aren't the launching part. It's, you know, could be social media or something, or something else, or a live experience. And then but you've created this whole story that all these pieces are going to, they're all going to, you know, work with the story, but they're going to be in different media. Mm. And part of that was, I was just watching my own kids. When they're watching TV, they're on the phone, they're playing a game. They might have the TV and a YouTube channel on. The way people are consuming media now is in so many different ways that rather than just replicating the same thing in each media, you have something that's related to the core story, but is different. Mm. So what that does is if you see it here in your game, you'll want to go see the show. Or if you see the show, you'll want to read the book. You'll want to read, you know, the Roblox thing or whatever we're doing. So that's basically a super narrative. The difference between transmedia is transmedia does something similar, but the difference in super narratives, you think right from the start to do this. It's creatively, it's not hard to do. It's very hard to convince the people with the money that finance these things to actually do them. Lego, they're rich and they're creative and, you know, they're collaborative, you know, they're, you know, and look at, think of, you know, Vikings, you know, rowing across the Atlantic in unison, you know, to get to the Americas 1,000 years ago. There's obviously something in their DNA that, you know, is very collaborative if they can do that. So when they're able to go to their departments and say, we're going to do this, you know, and we're going to do 6 things, a book, a game, a live event, a toy, a show, one or two or three of them is not going to make money, but it's all, when you add it all together, it's going to be a huge success. In an American company, that's almost impossible to do because every division within a company is competing against the other company. Mm. So I can't go into Disney and say, it's going to be a show, but we want to support it with this game. The game may not make money. The show is going to make $1 billion, but the game may not. That won't happen because the division head will say, you know, when it comes time for me to get my promotion, they're going to say you lost a bunch of money. Hmm. So they don't think holistically in, you know, in the US. I'm doing some work with a brand called Pudgy Penguins now that does kind of think that way. They are doing things like that, but that's, you know, they're young. they haven't been beaten down by the entertainment industry and this corporate structure that pits everyone against each other.
Yeah. And when you do have the most amount of freedom or say to be able to intervene in these kind of processes, where do you like to start and why? Like if you have your ideal landscape as a creator?
Usually I write a, you know, treatment. Mm. My Bibles, I have story Bibles, like the Chima Bible was probably at the end of the day over 400 pages because there's multiple characters. It's a toy property with a collectible element, so you have a lot of characters. And all those characters have stories, and some of them have, you know, mythologies. I mean, Legends of Chima is basically Game of Thrones with animals. So it's a bunch of these sort of competing tribes of animals, and each animal tribe has their own kind of religion or mythology that, you know, and their own sort of culture. The story Bible goes into that, and you'll see little bits of it in the show, but then in certain of the, you know, the super narrative elements, you'll see more. So I usually just start with this big, broad story and then, you know, and, you know, figure out what makes sense to go where, you know, what, is this a live event? Is this a toy? And when I say toys, I mean, yes, we're selling things, but the toy itself is a part of the story. The toys, it tells a story. The cover of the box tells a story. Mm. And then in my perfect world, the end consumer, the kids, they take my story and then make up their own stuff. Once I see fan fiction based on my characters, initially, you know, you're always a little shocked to see that because like, what are they doing? But then like, we won, you know, that's what they love a character so much, they're going to spend time making up their own stories. And I mean, that's what kids do when they play, they make up their own stories. And when they get older, they actually write it on fan sites. Of course, a lot of them are, you know, a lot of the fan fiction is about characters having sex that shouldn't be having sex, but you know, you take your wins where you can get them.
So. That does seem to be an obsession of our age, does it, in terms of who gets shipped with
that
who.
That age. Some of the fans are, you know, they're middle-aged people,
Totally. I mean, our age as in like as all living, not necessarily our age group. Yeah, absolutely. And what do you think some of the mistakes that you can be really be prevented if a writer or creator like yourself is brought in who understands this? Like when you sit from the outside and it's not working well, what do you think people have not understood, say in terms of character or world or tone? How do you think about it?
Just be aware people lie. It's the entertainment industry. Right. And what I mean by that is I'll go in and everyone will be like, everyone I pitch something like this to thinks it's the best idea ever and that's all they want to do. But at the end of the day, no, they don't. It doesn't end up happening. I mean, I've tried a dozen times and the Lego thing and Pudgy Penguins might be the only two that are coming close. And even that, you know, has a life of its own and it's, you know, they're doing their other things outside of my story. Just be aware that everyone's going to love something like this. They're going to love that you're thinking like this because they know. I mean, in the US now, the broadcast networks, if you had a show that got less than, when I started, you know, 20 years ago, if you had a show that was less than 5 million viewers or 4 million viewers, you got canceled. Now, those same networks are only getting like 100,000 viewers.
Right.
So they have to think outside of the box and not just count count on this model, but it's Hollywood is the most, it's, they're so stuck in the 20th century. And, you know, there's things that work for them and they don't want to innovate. So that's, so be aware. People will love your ideas, so they'll, but they won't actually do them because they want to do the same old thing that they can know they can count on. Other things, you know, trying to keep track of it, you know, you have to, I create the master plan, the master blueprint with one of these multi-hundred page Bibles, but you have to still pivot, you know, things are going to work, you know, or not work, you know, and now we have a lot of, especially now we're doing a lot of social media content and we have all these analytics where we can tell, we could tell exactly, we could tell exactly when people are shutting our stuff off. We could, I could look at a YouTube analytics and tell like when my joke bombed,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And and it's not just bombing in a room, it's bombing in front of 100,000 people or more, you know? So, you know, you use the analytics and, you know, you change. You come up with the best plan, best story ever, but if the audience doesn't like it, you know, you have to move. And sometimes the audience, they want the same old stuff. That's always, as a creator, you're like, I want to create the most original thing. And then my most original things flop.
Yeah.
So,
and
be aware, please the audience, basically.
Yeah. And how do you think about bringing in things like jokes or humorous tone when the audience is potentially so vast? Like, do you picture like your own kids? You're right. Like, how do you even calibrate that?
It's very challenging because I do a lot of international work. Because I mean, the American kids broadcast industry is, it's in rapid decline, or it's circling the drain. You know, so but there's still, you know, still things happening in Europe because they get subsidies from the government, so they're still able to put together their financing for productions. And I end up doing a lot of European broadcasts, and we have to be really careful with that too, because things in America don't necessarily translate, and language, you know, references don't translate. You know, Britain, they call lots of things different words. I never understand, you know, there's the exact same thing as a slightly different word. So, I mean, it has to be really broad. You have to sort of take into account language. The less language you can put in, the better. The less current you can be, the less news reflecting you can be, the better. I mean, unless you're doing a news show, if you're doing like a TV Nation, but for the most part, you have to keep it broad if you want a big audience, or, you know, you don't get a big audience, or you just focus on your 1,000 viewers or your 10,000 viewers. That's fine too. And you can make money that way. So, I mean, I think there's no overall answer, but to reach millions, it has to be pretty broad, nonverbal and timeless, you know, nothing that references anything too specific. And we have huge problems in all my productions with technology. We don't know. You put a cell phone in there and they may be different 3 years from now when the production is complete, you know? So there are plenty of shows I made by the time the show came out, you know, that thing didn't exist anymore, that whatever it was.
Yeah. It's moving so fast. And when you do think about, like you've talked about these kind of Bibles that you're building, and you described some of the things that might go into the world. When you're thinking about the characters, how are you thinking about that in terms of a system that can then be expanded? Like, do you just really get to be creative and think, oh gosh, this would be fun? Or are you working off systems and thinking, right, we need these kind of archetypes? You know, I can think of so many ways that it could happen. I'd love to know how you actually do think about it.
I try to think of it as, you know, the most original thing possible and base it on people I know or parts of myself that I would like to imagine. You know, I'd like to imagine myself as a hero or, I don't know, race car driver or whatever. But at the same time, you know, I know the audience, they're going to want the archetypes. They're going to want the dumb guy. They're going to want the smart guy, smart girl. It's usually the smart girl these days.
Yeah.
They're going to want the gadget person. They're going to want the muscle, the strong person, you know. And then in terms of like how it's going to work, you know, beyond the core story. I mean, if you want to create something toyetic or something with merchandise, put the car in there, put the vehicle, put all sorts of things have them make sense. Don't just give Spider-Man a car that he doesn't need, you know, create worlds and characters that require things. And then also just, you know, keep everything simple at its core. So it's always a simple story with all these layers, and the layers play out in the main format as well as all the other platforms. So like Chima, I said it was Game of Thrones, but it was really two best friends that had a falling out. That's the entire, that's the core of the story. There's 100 characters, but it's really about these two, a lion, Laval the lion and Cragger the crocodile that have a falling out.
And are there really 100 characters? Because I was reading about in your article.
I think there's more of them.
Is there really?
I think that's common with toys. Yeah. They especially something that has a collectible element. And every time you buy a Lego set, it comes with a different character. That's part of their business models. Like they make, that's how they get you to get the other sets. And I had to name them all. I made most of my name, not only name them, but create names because it's a merchandise, names that can be trademarked in multiple countries.
Right. Gosh.
So, yeah. So that's, I lean towards made up words like Cragger, which is Jagger and Dagger and Crocodile. He's a crocodile. So Cragger, And Laval, I partially grew up in Quebec City and there was a university there called Laval University. So that's what it's based on. But then that had a problem because there was some, Nazi sympathizer in World War II in France that was named Laval. So who knew, there's a problem with every single name you come up with.
Yeah.
So, now I use for name generation. That's one of the best uses of AI I find. Say, give me a list of 50 names of a character like this. And you get, out of 50, you might get to, a couple handful that are good, and that might clear, or you combine them. I mean, that's really one of the best things of AI. I've tried a lot of AI stuff too, and it's helpful. It nothing is submission ready.
Yeah.
Except the names. And sometimes jokes actually.
Okay. It comes
up with some jokes.
And how do you think about prompting it for jokes? Do you tell it the kind of general thing that you want the joke to be about?
Yes.
Yeah.
The more specific information you can give it, the better. I mean, I've even done things like those Bibles I told you about, put the whole Bible into ChatGPT and say, tell me some stories based on this or tell me, come up with some characters. And it's a lot of garbage, but the more you can give it, the more of a better response you can get. I know AI is sort of heresy to praise it at the moment, but it's really good for the stuff I do.
Yeah. And also, because I have friends and know people who work in children's TV, and my husband worked in children's TV for a long time. And so hearing a lot of conversations that you were talking about the US companies, but just how fast the pipeline is moving now. So just in terms of how creators are able to actually produce things at the rate that's required. So I'm also talking to writers who just for really practical reasons are having to kind of use it as a tool to kind of co-do things to keep up with the speed at which they're being required to produce.
Well, you're required to produce a lot more for less money.
Yeah.
the fees, certain people at the top of Netflix are making a bundle, but the rest of us doing these everyday shows I'm probably getting paid half of what I was getting paid 20 years ago in general, but on the plus side, there's AI. For idea generation, it's fantastic. For final output, it's terrible.
Yeah.
But if you need to just like, I need, there's five kids on a treasure hunt, give me 10 things that might happen to them.
Yeah.
And nine of them are stupid. And one's like, and it's a starting point. I don't see it. I think it's years away from being an ending point. But you could tell. You could see when at this point, you could tell when something is AI. I mean, I can tell because I do enough of it. It's kind of the bland. And here's a weird thing. People have been using it for the past 5 years because I started using it before ChatGPT. And there were anytime you go on the internet and look up something, it's like, 10 best electric vehicles. That's probably written by, it's a blog that someone wrote with AI, but probably like 3 years ago or something.
Yeah.
So we've been reading it on the internet, for the past 5 years.
Yeah.
Which is weird because now the large language models are learning from the internet, which is based on, AI. So it's AI, it's this recursive thing that may be the end of the world eventually, but for now it's pretty good.
Yeah. And So, I mean, so many things I wouldn't have thought of that you've mentioned with regards to super narrative. And I think it's really useful for as a creators to at least sort of like have in mind as a way of thinking about, like you say, watching how people are consuming things and where attention's going. And like you say, your children are having the phone and the this and the that. Like it's, if we're really purist, we may just become completely irrelevant. So really great to be thinking in these terms. Is there anything that you think that we've missed in terms of like a first dose for people thinking about super narrative and different platforms?
You know, think big and keep track of the new technology and, you know, try new things. I mean, you try a lot of things, fail fast. I mean, that's, I mean, someone smarter than that probably said that, but, I mean, that's kind of what we do. I mean, it's we don't know if it's going to work. And here's my overall thing. I learned two things I learned in Hollywood. Say yes, pick up the phone when someone calls and say yes, it doesn't matter what it is. The other thing is nobody knows anything. Even after, you know, 25 years, I still don't know. I could take better guesses than some other people, but I don't know. There's things I've done. I thought this will be a monster hit and it flops. And then there's things I thought were the worst projects ever. And they're the ones that live on and on and on. So no one knows. So if you don't know anything, you're on the same level. You're already there.
Yeah, that's very reassuring.
So don't worry about it. Yeah. And almost not knowing is better because you'll try weird things that I wouldn't try and it'll work. So and celebrate your ignorance of the entertainment industry. It'll help you out in the end.
Oh, I love that. And I love that. And clearly you have tried so many things and your site is a delight. Like I had, I go on, there's a bit where we can follow through your CV as a game. Like with the prompts and you can put it in. I was like, that's just the most fun way ever of looking at someone's work. And I love that you've described how you did the little Lego thing for a job too. So really inspiring to just bring creativity to all aspects, not just our like absolute chosen, like purest, most wonderful field of writing, but all of it. I love it.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because I thought it was a really clever way of explaining my credits. It's a little word, you know, it's a little text adventure.
Yeah,
and that so, I actually used AI to write the code. I mean, I still had to fix it up, but it's a text adventure, and no one ever says anything about it. I thought it was real. It's like ridiculous, so look for new ways to communicate.
Yeah,
I mean, so I don't know. I don't know if that works. You know, a week from now I'll have another idea.
I thought it was really fun. So listeners, I'm going to put in the show notes John's website, and we'll put some other links in as well, but you can get to go and see it, and it'll prompt, and it's like, do you want like the bit when the music came on and I could hear your voice coming through. It's really great. So I'm not going to describe it anymore. Listeners, you have to have a go and look for yourself. But again, I love the playfulness. I loved like on your site as well seeing the game that you designed that was like across the road that was linked to cars. Like that honestly, there's so many treats where you can see just how creative John is.
I was a street artist for a little bit. Yeah. It was 2009, 2010. There was no work. So I'm like, all right, well, what do I do now? I got a grant to do a sidewalk game.
Yeah.
And you move across these squares. They're colored squares according to what color car passes. And it was featured in something called Indiecade, which is a festival of games. But they also, I got the local city to pay for it. So I'm technically a street artist and a game designer.
Yeah.
But, you know, then I started getting work again and I left that behind. So just keep trying new things.
Well, exactly. You're a living, breathing example of that. I love it. So one last question before we wrap up is just, what are you currently enjoying watching or reading or listening in the comedy or entertainment field?
Oh,
it doesn't have to be current. It can be the last few years.
It's funny because I usually think about the things I don't like.
Oh, do you? Okay. We won't give them a bad shout out.
Oh, no. I was just complaining today that I thought Oppenheimer was okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
I've been watching the new Curb Your Enthusiasm, of course, is really funny.
Okay.
The Larry David Show.
Yeah.
Really just... I basically get a streaming service for a month and then cancel it. So we happen to have HBO Max this month.
Yeah.
So I'm watching. Oh, one of my shows actually, Squish, is now available in the UK on a pop channel. Is there a channel called Pop or something? An internet channel. So Squish is it's basically microscopic an amoeba in middle school, and he's got a friend who's a paramecium, and it's all these microscopic organisms in middle school, kind of like a Charlie Brown sort of character, but everyone's a single-celled organism.
That's fun.
All right. Yeah. I'll be quick about this. It came out in February 2020 on a French channel.
Yeah.
And what happened in February, we had a character called Vinny the Virus.
Oh.
So Vinny the Virus is this little ball with spikes, which looked exactly like a coronavirus.
Yeah.
So it came out on February 2020 and was immediately pulled off like on March 2020.
Yeah.
No one would touch it because, and there are characters that are bacteria and germs. It has nothing to do with coronavirus. It was written years before.
Yeah.
But there's an example of a really good show that got, destroyed by circumstances,
yeah,
but is now coming back. It's on Pop Channel. I think it might be on Gulli in France and a couple of other European networks. They've gotten over their fear of my coronavirus shaped bully.
Oh.
So watch that if you can.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Oh, that's a great place to end. A great place of an example of, things failing or dying a death beyond your control, but then resurrection from the virus death. So that's good. Oh, John, my goodness. So many things I could ask about. What a joy getting to hear about some of your wonderful creative projects today. And thank you for introducing us to Super Narrative. Where should people go to find out more about you and your work? And I'll put these links in the show notes.
Just go to my webpage. If you can actually spell my name, it's johnderevlaney.com.
Yes.
And I do sometimes respond to people. So if you have questions, you can ask me. But don't ask me about the Angry Beavers. Too many people ask me about Angry Beavers, a show I worked on 30 years ago. Yeah. And I probably want to answer questions about Angry Beavers. Any other question? I will respond to.
Yeah, I'm not sure now whether listeners are going to throw down the gauntlet.
They're all going to ask me about Angry Beavers. It was a popular show in the late 90s, early 2000s on Nickelodeon, but I just get
too
many.
You just little over the Beavers.
I got too many weird questions. the fans of that show are different than all the other fans of my shows.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, they're a little obsessive, mm-hmm, and I get some of them do catfishing things where they'll send an email under one name and then they'll send an email under another name saying, hey, why didn't you respond to my friend over here? It's strange things. So no angry. Any other question in the world, I will answer.
Okay, that's fair.
About anything.
That's fair. Awesome. I'll put this in the show notes. So fun chatting with you today, John. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.